because our lives are politically motivated first, and we have made our theology, we have shaped our theology based on our politics and not the other way around, I think the tension is going to continue.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org.
In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Terrell Carter. He's a pastor of Webster Groves Baptist Church, an executive director and president of Rise, a nonprofit in St. Louis, Missouri. He's also author of the brand new book, Family Feuds: Forgotten Bible Rivalries and What the Church Can Relearn About Reconciliation. I was really excited to be able to have Terrell on the program. I've known him for several years. He's a contributing writer for Word and Way. And this is an interesting book that I think that you're going to enjoy. But before we jump into the conversation, I do want to remind you that if you haven't already, you need to subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness. Learn more, start reading, and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. Now here's my conversation with Terrell Carter about family feuds. Well, Terrell, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to talk with you. Of course, you know, had the pleasure of knowing you for quite some time and working alongside you. And so it's exciting to have this conversation about your newest book, Family Feuds: Forgotten Bible Rivalries and What the Church Can Relearn About Reconciliation. So let's start with maybe big picture. What are you trying to do in this book, and why? Why did you decide you wanted to tackle this topic?
That's a really simple question, but it's also kind of hard for me to answer because it's not just one simple answer. When you look at everything that's going on in our culture, and not just in the culture, but in the church to some degree, we are just completely at odds with each other. As we are recording this, the House of Representatives can't even figure out how to choose a Speaker of the House yet. And it's, you know, going on 3 or 4 days of posturing and people who make commitments not to vote for a certain person because they didn't, you know, do something back in the past. And many of these people are, you know, Bible thumping, car carrying Christian evangelicals. And I don't say that disrespectfully. I don't use that phrase disrespectfully, but, you know, they are doing things and behaving and navigating an opportunity in a way that doesn't look very Christ-like. That's just one example. But over the past few years, and I hate to frame everything around Donald Trump because Donald Trump is a symptom of something larger, but, you know, Donald Trump's presidency was filled with a lot of disagreement, or not even Donald Trump, but the people that interacted with his decisions and his type of leadership. Again, Bible thumping, car carrying evangelicals who decided to, or began to believe, or began to verbalize rather, their long held beliefs that faith was something that should be really masculine and muscular and, you know, to be truthful in many ways, stood in opposition to what the Bible says. So I wrote this book as a way to kind of address some of those things, but it's not just about politics. It's about the everyday, you know, disagreements that people of faith have with each other, with people who view life differently than them, and how we can understand that disagreement is not necessarily a bad thing. Where it starts to get off the rails is when we behave in ways that don't align with what we say we believe, or this man, Jesus, who we say we follow. How do we get the train back on the track going in the right direction? So that's primarily the reason why I wrote this book.
Yeah. So, you know, you've kind of already done a little bit of a time reference. Obviously, maybe by the time this comes out, there will be a Speaker of the House. But as we're speaking on the morning of Friday, January 6th, there is not one yet after like 11 votes. But you also, you know, here we are speaking on the morning of January 6th. And I think you signed up for this time period before I actually started reading through your book. And then I noticed the preface. You start with
you know, January 6th. Yeah. Here we are on the 2-year anniversary of that. You know, you note that day that, and again, the book, you have a couple of chapters talk about politics and most of the chapters don't. And so, you know, it comes in at times, but you note there in the very beginning of how that day showed us how clearly our nation is divided along political and racial lines, but also among theological lines. And that's very important.
Yeah. When you look at what, there's an irony, I didn't realize the irony of this being the day that we decided to do this interview. When you look at, and you've written about this substantially, and you've talked about this, you know, in many venues yourself or avenues yourself. I mean, when you looked at what occurred on January the 6th, you had, you know, what was clearly an illegal action, but people tried to frame it in, as a positive theological thing. You saw people carrying American flags and Christian flags and Jesus is my president or Jesus, you know, and they made it out to be a righteous religious movement. And it was not. It was clearly, we wanted one person to win, that person didn't win. And so we're going to try to make something happen. But that shows how far we have fallen, how far we have gone, how far right or left our theology has shifted when we try to make the Christian faith the basis for, and not even a really good argument for it being the basis for these kind of political actions. And you had several people who justified it. I mean, nationally on public television, on multiple, you know, radio programs, that this was a righteous thing. Nowhere in this book that we say that we follow or believe the Bible, whether in the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament, was that kind of thing justified. And again, it's part of the purpose of this book is to say, we need to take a step back. We need to have a better understanding of what the Bible teaches and how that applies to our lives. Not in this book, but in a prior book I wrote about, and I forget the statistic at this moment, but Christians, American Christians are some of the most illiterate or biblically illiterate people in creation. Meaning we say that we believe this Bible, this book, but we don't even know what it really says. And there are, every year, there are multiple studies that come out that show that people can't pass, like, you know, the top two or three names, the top two or three events, whether it was the freeing of Israel or something similar to that. Outside of those major things, we don't have any idea of what this book says and how it's supposed to apply to us. And instead, we prefer someone else to tell us what it means, what it says, and how to believe and how to act. And then we just get in line with that. And again, part of the point of this book is to say, we have to have our own experience with the book. We have to have our own experience with what it says. And the creator of this book, that, you know, we believe that God is part of the creation of this book. We have to have our own relationship, our own experience, and we have to then live out that those combined experiences together. Again, it's not about getting along all the time or agreeing all the time, but there's a way to have disagreement. And, you know, January 6th, those kinds of actions are not the ways to have disagreements.
Yeah. And then obviously one of the points that you're making there is how much then, because of the biblical literacy and other issues, that these political divides, these social divides, they then change the way we act in our churches and in our day-to-day relationships. And I want to note that you're coming, you know, this from a perspective of, you've been a pastor for many years, you've been a seminary professor, I know you've worn a lot of hats, but you've thought about what these political and racial divides, how they play out in local congregations and how pastors have to struggle. And I've heard from many pastors over the last several years about how difficult of a time period this has been for them, because people, you know, too often are starting with politics first and then, you know, allowing that to frame how they read the Bible when they do pick it up. So, I mean, how has, as a pastor, and I know you have that pastoral perspective, how has this been, you know, whether in personal experience of what you've known from students and other, you know, colleagues, how has this impacted the churches?
So luckily, So I've been a pastor of the pastor of Webster Groves Baptist Church in St. Louis for 7 years now. And one of the things you did mention was I'm a former police officer for the city of St. Louis as well. So I bring all of those different kind of perspectives together. Luckily, the family, the congregation, the body that I serve with, this has not become, for us, it was not a major thing. We are like much of the United States in the sense that we are divided down the middle. We have very conservative people on one side, very liberal people on another side, and then people who are down the middle just trying to figure it out as well. But we have learned how to have conversation when appropriate about these things and for it to be something that does not divide us. But we've also learned sometimes we don't have to talk about, you know, my opinion doesn't have to be known about every single thing. And I think that that's one of the things we've forgotten how to do. Sometimes it's just good to shut up. Sometimes it's good to not have to make your opinion known. That doesn't mean you're not being true to yourself. That doesn't mean that you're not being true to your values. But when you get to learn and understand other people, you learn that, you know, one of the things that my wife and I try to do on a regular basis is fight fair. And what I mean by that is we don't say things, we don't do, in times of tension in our relationship, we don't say things, we don't do things that intentionally try to set each other off. And I think that Webster Groves does a very good job of not trying to set each other off. But also, more important than almost any of that is we love each other, and our relationships are more important than just being right or, you know, making sure that we have the last say. So again, our congregation is, I think, not one of the outliers, but in my circle, we have been very blessed that it has not caused, these kinds of things have not caused us to separate or to hurt our fellowship. Now, I have colleagues who are not as lucky. You know, it's the refrain, the story is, you know, and has been for several years about, you know, congregations that have split because one group loved Trump and one group loved Obama or Biden. And again, the emphasis is not on Trump, is the emphasis is on these two polar opposites that we have decided to, that we have made the most important, you know, parts of our political body, our political process. Yeah, I talk to people on a regular basis and hear from people on a regular basis where their lives, their ministries, the congregations that they serve, you know, are in regular turmoil because people don't know how to fight fair. They don't know how to, you know, again, sometimes just be quiet and trying to hear somebody else's side of the story. We have gotten to this point again of I have to be right and you have to believe the same thing I believe. And if not, then there's something wrong with you. That misses the whole point of the Bible. Again, we have in the New Testament, when after Jesus died, rose again, and the church began, it was all Jewish, you know, people involved in the church. Jesus was a Jew, and you know that was his family, his people group. But the New Testament teaches us that non-Jews began to believe, and then they wanted to join the church, and there was this question of, is this right? You know, these, you know, Gentiles, what are we supposed to do with them? And eventually, you know, church leaders, you know, found themselves on opposite ends of the spectrum as it related. One group wanted complete separation. One group wanted full integration. And they figured out a way to meet in the middle. And Paul was given the opportunity to go be the disciple, the speaker to the Gentiles, and Lord bless you. And those of us over here are going to continue to be with, you know, people just like us, but we're not going to fight against each other. We're not going to try to destroy you. And we will continue to talk and see where this goes. But again, we lack even that kind of, in many ways we lack, or some ways we lack that civility now.
Yeah, and so that's one of the things that you do in this book. You know, you're taking a look at, all right, this is the cultural context in which we live, some of the issues that are happening, the divides that are happening in our culture, and then you're helping us see some examples in the scriptures where, you know, not a one-to-one, you know, match, but still that provide some ways of thinking about what does it mean to live as followers of God in this type of context. And so let's unpack a couple of those. We're, obviously, we won't get through all of them, so people will have to buy the whole book to get everything.
Yes, please, please do.
We won't give it all away here. So yeah, Gerald's like, please buy the book. It's a good book. And like I said, one of the things I appreciate is you're taking these stories in the scriptures and helping us, you know, think about them today. So for instance, you know, early on, you talk about Isaiah 2, which I think as we're here on the second anniversary of January 6th talking about this, I think is an important one to think about, this idea of uncertainty, of change in government, and all of the things that are happening. I wonder if you can help us, what's happening in Isaiah 2, and how does that help us in thinking about relationships and reconciliation?
So Isaiah is one of those Old Testament prophets that tried to call the people into account to get them to live in a way that God wanted them to. And the people did not necessarily do this. And the people, you know, didn't believe, could not see that something was going to occur. And eventually it did. And so part of the question that we have to think about is, well, I open that chapter up by talking about my grandfather, and I want to say this in a way that hopefully is respectful. My grandfather, like me, was an older Black gentleman, but he was raised under Jim Crow legislation and was a lifetime Democrat because of his life experiences. And I tell the story that on Thanksgiving of that particular year, my grandfather, who was usually a cranky man who complained about, you know, all the things that in the world that were wrong with politics, all the things in the world that was wrong with white people, that day he did not do any of that. He didn't have any kind of negative things. Not any kind of negative things, but he was in a very different position, even though the world was not exactly as he wanted it to be as it related to politics or anything. What my grandfather eventually came to understand again is that life does not always have to turn out the way we want it to. Things don't always have to turn out the exact way that we want them to, but that we can still find joy, we can still find peace, even when we are not right, even when things are not necessarily going the way that we want them to go, even when people that we think should not be in power, should not be in control, are in power and in control. And he was able to do that because he eventually, so my grandfather was a preacher. He was a pastor himself as well. He's one of my mentors. But eventually he, you know, fully bought into this idea that God is in control and that God wants us to engage in whatever this work that God is doing. God invites all of us to engage in this work and for us to try to represent him or represent our creator and represent the one who is trying to make this world a better place. So that's how I start out that chapter. And I think that idea, one of the other things that comes up in Isaiah is this idea of when something goes wrong, where is God? Why is God not acting the way that we want God to? And it forces us to ask questions, some universal questions like, did we put ourselves in this position? You know, did we do the things that we were supposed to do? And if so, what does that mean? And if we did not do the things that we're supposed to do, what does that mean? And now I'm not saying that, you know, that because something happens in our lives, God is punishing us. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is, and what I think my grandfather would say is that we have a part that we play in God's creation, a part that we play in God's world. And like the children of Judah and the children of Israel in the Hebrew Bible, God has given us an outline for how life is supposed to go or how God wants us to navigate life and our relationships. And when we don't follow that outline, when we don't honor the relationships, when we don't honor what God is trying to do in this world through us, then there are consequences. And how do we understand that? How do we navigate that? That's essentially the kind of questions that I was trying to ask in that chapter.
So I guess maybe as we look at our own political struggles and chaos, it's nice to know that others have experienced chaos before too, huh?
Right.
And speaking of thinking about conflict, particularly among nations, a few chapters later, you talk about what you call cousins fighting. And, you know, I think probably a lot of people, I mean, I say a lot, you already warned me that we have biblical illiteracy in our society, but a lot of people probably know the story of Jacob and Esau. But then what you end up doing in the chapter is tracing it much further on down through the story of their descendants, the Israelites and the Edomites. And that actually the story of Jacob and Esau is a long story throughout the scriptures. And so I wonder if you, I think that's really helpful for people to see this constant struggle between family members, essentially, throughout the biblical narrative. So I wonder if you can walk us through a little bit of what's happening there in this fight between cousins.
Yeah, Jacob and Esau, twin brothers who were born, Esau the older, Jacob the younger. Jacob swindled, tricked, whatever. And I've begun to study this passage in a, hopefully in a different way to try to have a better understanding of Esau, because we usually vilify Esau and just call him dumb. But some of the language in the original Hebrew suggests something different. The bigger point though is these fights that we start, you know, in our immediate circle have bigger ripples, bigger ramifications, because generations later, their descendants were still fighting each other based on the relationship that those two had. So the seeds of dissent and anger and frustration never died, you know. And what we find out through the scriptures is Jacob and Esau eventually reconciled. You know, Jacob ran for his life. I forget the exact passage, but it tells us that eventually he realized that Esau was still after him after he stole his birthright or swindled him out of his birthright. Esau never let that go. Years later, Jacob had been a wandering Aramean, if I'm remembering the phrase correctly, but Jacob had been a wandering, you know, person with his family, you know, huge family and property and all those things. And it comes to a point where he realizes that his brother is gaining ground on him and almost catching him. So he sends his wife, his family away so he can face his brother by himself. And instead of his brother trying to kill him, when he catches up with him, they reconcile, they hug, they kiss. And eventually his brother Esau tells him when Jacob is about to go fight someone else or deal with another kind of point of tension in his life, Esau says, "Hey, I will give you access to my army to protect you. This is how much I love you, and this is how much I want you and your family to be okay." Later on, each of them has their own children, and their children have their own children, and, you know, other tribes generations later. Israel is a small nation that's trying to, you know, make its own way and has its own enemies. And instead of their relatives, the Edomites, who are descendants of Esau, instead of the Edomites helping Israel, they help their enemies. And not only do they help their enemies, Israel is trying to escape a particular situation. And Edom goes back to their enemies and tells them, "Hey, this is how you get to them. They're trying to escape this way. If you go do this, you'll catch them." But that wasn't the only thing. As part of that whole process, Edom also, while some of the Israelites were trying to escape the turmoil that was occurring, they hurt the Israelites themselves as well. They captured some and killed some and did all of those things. And in a particular book of the Bible, if I'm remembering it correctly, it's in Obadiah, God tells the nation of Edom, "You have messed this up. Like, you had an opportunity to help your cousins. Here goes the history of your two families. Your two families were supposed to be blessed. And instead of showing love and protecting them, you help their enemies. And because you did that, I hold you fully accountable. And not only do I hold you fully accountable," God says, "I'm going to punish you for generations now as well." The bigger point, again, is these kinds of frustrations and disagreements and negative relationships that we have serve as examples for future generations as well. How do we stop that? Now, in Christian culture, there's this phrase that has lost some popularity. We used to call it like generational curses. And with that, it was the idea that something that happened long ago has an effect on, you know, a current generation. And I don't necessarily believe that idea, especially the way that it was utilized in, you know, prosperity gospel, prosperity theology. But I do believe that there is some truth to this idea that, you know, these seeds that we plant in our children and in our families, they grow. And if we plant this foundation of everything has to be a fight, we always have to be right. The only people that can be part of our circle are people that believe exactly like we believe. Those are those negative seeds that eventually turn or cause or lead to situations like Edom and Israel, where, you know, we have every reason in the book to be working together, protecting each other, loving each other, doing something, you know, for the world, for God's world, together. And instead, we look for reasons to separate and not to work together. And we look for reasons to hurt each other instead of reasons to help heal and build so we can participate in this work that God is doing together.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a great reminder of not only, you know, obviously you're talking about personal relationships and you know, reconciliation, but then, you know, how what we do can impact generations upon generations, and it can be hard to break. And a lot of what we're dealing with in our society, politically, racially, theologically, a lot of these divides are generations in the making.
Yeah.
Which makes them that much more difficult to undo.
Yeah, you look at any of these names, it's so I you know that I'm working on multiple books all at the same time, almost continually. And I'm working on a book.
So you're writing like all the time. I mean, I get a press release that you have a new book out, and I'm like, already?
Yeah. the point is, I'm doing some research about the, you know, the conservative. And again, because I critique these kinds of things, doesn't tell you what my politics are. And I've said that multiple times in the book. Again, just because somebody calls out what someone else is doing that may not be good, positive, or biblical, that doesn't mean that you have to hate that person or, you know, any. The point is, like, so I'm doing some research on conservative Christian history, and many of the names that appear at the very beginning are the names that are current right now. You know, it's almost like a family business. And what I mean by that is that, you know, these conservative parents have, and it's not just conservative, it's liberal. You can do it on both sides. But you look at any of our major political parties and you can see names like McCain. How many McCains have we had in politics? How many Bushes have we had in politics? How many, you know, you name it, it becomes a legacy kind of thing. So how do we, and look at our, you know, our church traditions. We are both Baptists. We are both part of the same Baptist world. But, you know, when you look at the SBC, the Southern Baptist Convention, how many people are just legacies of a different generation? And because they are part of or from a particular family are given leadership opportunities or their voice carries more weight. And it would be wonderful. And this may be asking too much, but, you know, for people to start having these intentional conversations of saying, okay, we understand that this is what it used to be and this is what my family's name meant, but how could it mean something even greater or something even more substantial, and trying to turn things around and trying to create a bridge instead of a divide?
So you devote several chapters in the book to thinking about conflict and resolution in the early church, and, you know, by then, extension to churches today. And I think that's, you know, obviously we've spent a lot of time already talking about politics and, you know, nation level, but this focus on conflict and relationships and reconciliation inside of churches is also really important. And I think, you know, maybe big picture before we look at maybe a specific example is just this idea of, you know, why is it so hard? I mean, because sometimes this is something you hear. We hear complaints from those outside the church. Non-believers, you know, might say, well, why would I join a church? You all just fight all the time, you know, just like the rest of the world, or maybe even worse than, you know, why is it that we seem to fight each other so much, it seems like, inside of churches?
I've kind of alluded to this a couple of times already, is that we want to be right. We want to be the one that has the correct answer. And this is just one of the reasons we want to be right. We want to be the one that has the correct answer. A lot of it, I believe, comes from that. But I think that also some of it comes from confusion and misapplication. And what I mean by that is, again, the Bible never tells us that if somebody thinks differently from us, then we have to destroy them. I mean, sometimes people will try to point to the Hebrew Bible and, you know, the things that are talked about in, you know, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, where God talks about separating people or separating from other tribes and things like that. There was a very particular purpose and reason why the people were told that. God wanted them, if I'm understanding the Hebrew Bible correctly, God had called a particular group of people to God's self, that God would be their God. But here's the thing, God never said that you can't believe in other gods. It was, you cannot worship or follow other gods. I recognize me even saying that now opens up a different kind of Pandora's box or can of worms for people to think about. But at no point does God ever say, like, you know, people that follow Baal or follow Baal, that they deserve death because they follow Baal or Baal. The reason why God had a not good view of them, it seems like, is because they had positioned themselves against Israel, not based on being a different God, but they wanted what Israel had. They wanted the land that God had promised Israel, those different kinds of things. So it wasn't even the separation, the tension in that story is not because of what we think it is. That's what I'm trying to get to. So when you do a much more in-depth study, what you learn is the tensions that we see in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible are not based on what we think they are on the surface. It's about something completely different. And so what I'm trying to get to is, I think that we have this misperception, this misunderstanding of what those tensions, what it meant to be in conflict with someone in the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament. And we just run with it without, again, the literacy that we need in order to understand that this is what this is really about. We take something that sounds really familiar or sounds really simple, and then we run with it instead of saying, oh, let me make sure I understand this and that I can really apply. Because some of the stuff that we recognize or that we read that we encounter in the Bible doesn't apply to us anymore. You know, the specific tension points, you know, actions, laws, requirements, celebrations, whatever, they don't necessarily apply to us anymore. But the principles that underlie them do apply to us. But again, how do we understand them in their original context? And then how do we then move that application to today? And if it applies, it does. If it doesn't, it does not. But it's never going to be exactly like it was back then. And I'm sorry, because it sounds like I'm talking in circles, and that's not what my intent is. My intent is to say that we have to have a better understanding. I know I've mentioned this again already, but we have to have a better understanding of what the story is that the Hebrew Bible, that the Old Testament, that the New Testament is trying to tell, and what it means for us. Some of it does have meaning for us now. Some of it does not, but we cannot use those things as the platform, the foundation, you know, for us to stand on if we don't even understand them in the first place.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
So, you know, obviously one of the issues that you deal with a little bit in this book, and even more so in some of your other books, is issues related to race and racism. We've talked a little bit about, you know, the fact that you're a pastor, but, you know, I think this is an area that a lot of churches may not even realize, but particularly white churches may not realize how they're divided on issues of race and how there are relationships that are broken on that topic. But I wonder if you could share a bit more about you and your church, how you all are crossing a racial divide that exists. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. didn't come up with the saying, but he popularized it, that the idea that the church hour is the most segregated hour of the week. So I wonder if you can talk about that, because I think it is a helpful way of us thinking about a lot of the issues that you're writing about.
So for the listener, I'm African-American. I mean, I don't know if everybody already assumed that. I already knew that.
I can see you, but no, everyone's just listening to you. So
right. So I am African-American. I've been African-American for 49 years, almost 50 years now.
Not that we'll age you or date you here, but you know.
Oh, I'm proud of my age. I just laugh because it makes me think about the Washington Redskins quarterback who was Black, who won the Super Bowl. And the first thing one of the reporters asked him was like, so how long have you been a Black quarterback? He's like, all my life. What are you talking about? Anyway, right. So I'm African-American. The congregation that I serve is a historically white congregation. So I'll give just a very brief background. I answered my call to ministry when I was 16. I was raised in the Black church tradition. I'm a fifth generation pastor, preacher, however you want to phrase it. Both my father was in ministry. Both my grandfathers were pastors. Great grandfather was a pastor. And I remember going to his church when we were children. All of his grandkids and his great grandkids served as the choir. And then one of my great-great-grandfathers was in ministry. The point is that as I grew and served in ministry, I anticipated serving in congregations like the ones that I grew up in. Went to seminary, went to university, got all the requisite education, thinking that I was going to go back into the communities that I grew up in and, you know, be able to bring this whatever to them, and never was never called to serve a Black congregation. I there are a couple of different ways. I'm in an interracial marriage as well. And that has served as a tension point in some of the congregations that I attempted to serve very, very clearly. I remember when my wife and I, we were dating, but, you know, knew we were getting married. She started to go with me to opportunities for me to preach. And when Black congregation members would see me with this white woman, they were not happy. So this frustration goes along both sides. So it's not just with white congregations, it's with all congregations that don't recognize the value of all humanity and the equality of all humanity. But I eventually was called to serve the congregation where I'm at now. And, you know, one of the funny things about this is that I don't believe they had this idea. I believe, and they have expressed this to me, they called me because they specifically said, you are the person that God has most clearly spoken through to us. And we believe that you are supposed to be our pastor. Wonderful. Some people automatically thought, oh, well, our congregation is going to become more diverse. It did not. I was not the first Black person to serve on staff. They had an intern from a seminary that's located, you know, very closely to our facility. So they've had other people of color serve on a staff position, but I was the first senior lead, whatever, pastor. One of the things that I have intentionally chosen not to do is like, I don't necessarily preach about race from the pulpit. What I do is I make sure that I say whatever it is the Bible says. So now there are application points that relate to race, but there are also application points that relate to gender, that relate to economics, all those things. And so I try to make sure that all of those things are brought up, but not just race. But I have also tried to intentionally make space for conversations about race in other ways. So we have invited other community groups to come in and to participate in things. And, you know, so those kinds of things were happening on a regular basis before COVID. But I also have to acknowledge, and I want to make sure that I say this, I'm hoping I say this in the best way possible. You know, many members or some of the members of our congregation consider themselves to be colorblind. And you and I have talked about this before. I don't like that phrase, because when you say that you are colorblind, that means that you don't see me. You don't see some of the most important things about my life. You know, again, I'm a Black male, which means that I have a very particular experience growing up in St. Louis. I'm a Black male who served as a police officer for the city of St. Louis, which makes my experiences even more different than anyone else's. I'm a Black male who has a doctorate degree, and I don't, that's not a brag. That's me saying, like, I've gone through a very particular educational path where I've had to leave, or not lose, but set aside, you know, many of the things that were important to me and my educational upbringing, to set those aside to accept and to be able to speak a language that's not necessarily originally mine. You know, the theologies that I was taught in seminary and Bible college did not necessarily give space to the Black experience, or the womanist experience, or the poor experience, or whatever. It was a very particular kind of experience of reading certain books, certain authors, certain theology, speaking a certain language. And so when you tell me you are colorblind, I get what people mean by that. And it's an honorable thing. And they see it as an honorable thing. But it's also something that essentially says, well, some of the most important things about you, Terrell, I'm going to ignore those, or those are not going to be. And they, the people that say that, don't see it that way necessarily. Again, they see it as an honorable thing of like, no, I want to take you as the person that you are. I don't want all these other peripheral things to influence what I think about you. Well, unfortunately, those things are and should influence what you think about me, because they are very critical to who I am and to why I think what I think. But again, my ethnicity, my skin color is not the only thing about me, but it is obviously one of the important things about me. And so there's this dance that I don't think the church recognizes that we are always in, because again, I don't emphasize it on a regular basis. My goal is to be the pastor, the brother in Christ that this congregation needs. Right now there are some other things that occur in our lives that we emphasize or we focus more on, because it's the common experience of most of those people that go to our church. So, but again, I always want to make sure to emphasize that they love me and my family. They treat us so graciously. And this book actually is dedicated to them. And anyone who reads it will see in the foreword or the dedication that I dedicated to Webster Groves, because I do want to, I say to them, like, thank you for being patient with me as I've learned to become the pastor that you need. But I also dedicate the book to my grandparents as well, Genevieve and Jerry Carter, who I dedicate every single book to, because again, two Black, my grandparents obviously were Black as well again, but two Black people who grew up under Jim Crow laws and who had very particular experiences, who tried to teach me and my twin brother that life can be bigger than what your experiences have been. Your life can be bigger than what our experiences have been as your grandparents. And here's how we will try to help you see the world in a different way.
So, I mean, obviously there's a lot that has happened in society and in church life the last few years. You know, we've talked about some of the political challenges and divides. You've referenced COVID, which was a disruption to churches and society and in so many ways. And other aspects have been, technology has been changing. What do you see moving forward? Do you think that the tensions and the divides are going to continue to remain strong and maybe even grow? And as we're moving forward, you know, what is the role of Christians in our society, in this moment that we find ourselves in?
So my intent is not to sound like a pessimist, but I don't see things getting.
Hey, when society, when things are going poor, a realist sounds like a pessimist. Right. There you go. So.
Well, I just want to be a realist, unfortunately, because we are not seeing, like, so let me rephrase it. Let me take a step back. In small pockets, I can see people working together, trying to, you know, find common ground. But because our lives are politically motivated first, and we have made our theology, we have shaped our theology based on our politics and not the other way around, I think the tension is going to continue. We started out by talking about the fact that, you know, it's January the 6th, 2023, and we can't figure out a Speaker of the House. Well, we haven't even gotten to, you know, season to vote for the president, the next president. And we can only, if it's anything like it has been for the past, you know, 4 to 6 years, then things are only going to get worse. And unfortunately, I think that the United States, our history. And so I don't, this is not hyperbole. This is, again, based on all the research that I'm doing and the research I've done on human relationships as well. It's going to take something negative to happen that affects all of us, like a 9/11. And again, I'm not trying to be prophetic. I don't want it to, it's not that at all. I think it's going to take something large like that, that affects the entire nation, for us to stop, come together, realize that we've been going in the wrong direction, and then start moving forward together. And unfortunately, we know human nature. We have stories from the Bible. We have stories from history that's only going to last for so long as well. So I appreciate the fact that you said that, you know, the difference between a pessimist and a realist. My intent is to be a realist, not in a negative way, but even with that as my understanding of what I think is going to happen, that does not stop me from still preaching reconciliation constantly, teaching reconciliation constantly, writing about reconciliation constantly. And I think that I wish that there were more people, and I'm not saying that I'm the only one doing this, so please that's not it. But I would hope, I ask for more people who believe in reconciliation to start speaking up, because maybe that's part of what it's going to take in order for us to start having more of it. Again, I don't want it to sound like that. I'm saying, like, every time I walk down the street, somebody's fighting with each other. That's not it. But we are consistently bombarded with messages of everything that's going wrong and how things are not right and how, you know, everybody's on different sides. I'm asking, hoping, encouraging more people to do the same thing of, you know, of figuring out how they can reconcile with others and then how they can encourage other people to reconcile with each other as well. And let's start trying to get a groundswell of this message of reconciliation, of love, of treating people the way God wants us all to be treated. And maybe that'll start changing our politics, our political parties, because people do this because they know it will get them elected. They do this because they know that it gets clicks. They do this because they know that it gets advertising dollars. They do this because of, you know, for things that are not about doing what's right in the first place. So how do we start pushing back against that, those kinds of things, and start even again on the local level, on the smallest level, with the hope of it building to something greater? How do we start combating that on a regular basis and not just put our heads under a rock or put our heads in the sand and just say that it doesn't affect me? It affects us. It affects future generations, as we've talked about already.
Well, my last question for you is, I wanted to note that in addition to writing books and serving as a pastor, you're also a leader of a nonprofit in St. Louis. So I wonder if you wanted to give a shout out, tell us about RISE and who you all are and what you do.
Yep. I'm the president and executive director of RISE Community Development. RISE is a nonprofit community development corporation that's been around for 20 plus years in St. Louis. What we do is we participate in the process of redeveloping communities with other partners. And we do it primarily through real estate development. We build single family, multifamily, commercial units that are affordable, meaning the rents that people pay are below market. So if the market calls for $1,000 for rent for a two-bedroom apartment, we build an apartment that they can live in for $500 or $600. And sometimes we build them where you can live in them for even less than that. We do that in conjunction with multiple governmental programs and investments from community partners. In addition to that, we provide consulting and technical assistance services for people and groups that want to redevelop communities, not just through real estate, but through, you know, planning, through whatever it takes to redo, rehab, redevelop a community. And then we have another area. We are a financial lending institution as well. We are called a CDFI, a Community Development Financial Institution, and we provide low interest rate loans to people who want to participate in the redevelopment process. So one program we have specifically is for minority developers, minority builders, or people who work in the construction industry, women and minority-owned businesses. We provide loans for them to be able to operate their businesses. We also have another loan opportunity where we will fund developers who will build in our footprint. So it doesn't matter if you're a woman or a minority, if you're willing to go into a distressed community that we have identified, we will provide capital for you to build houses, rehab houses, you know, whatever it is. And we're also working to develop a few other loan opportunities, loan products for people as well. So you've talked about the fact that I've done a couple of different things in life. Construction, community development has been the thing that I've done the longest. I started in construction when I was 15 and continued to do that until I was 23 when I became a police officer. And from the age 23 to 28, I was a police officer. And then 28, I left the department and went back into construction all over again. Now, the dream had always been to be a, you know, a professor or, you know, seminary president. And I had the opportunity to be a seminary professor, like you said, full-time seminary professor at Central Baptist Seminary in Shawnee, Kansas, which was a dream. And then I became vice president of a Christian university called Greenville shortly after that. But then I felt this call back to community development, and I cannot describe it any other way, because I promised in 2015, when I left construction and community development to go to Central Seminary, I promised I was not going back into community development again. I promised. And then however many years later, 2023, I'm back. Oh, Lord. But it's clearly something that I believe that, and I would not have done it unless this is going to sound for the, so I believe that there are going to be people, friends of mine, who are not people of faith, who are going to listen to this. And so I'm always aware of the language that I use. It's, you know, it was something that I believe that God made clear that I was supposed to be at this place at this time. And that's not, I'm not trying to be cryptic. What I mean is, like, there were too many things that had to line up perfectly, that lined up perfectly. Like, I wasn't even looking for this job. Literally, I got a phone call from, I received a couple of phone calls from people I had not talked to in years who said, hey, there's this opportunity. Were you aware of it? And I was not. And then I received another phone call from somebody, you know, unrelated. Anyway, point is that this was something that I believe that God clearly had in store. And so my dream, my hope, my prayer, my goal is to live in this position and to make the world a better place through this position, like I have tried to do in all the other positions that I've had before. So Rise, you can visit our website at www.risestl.org, R-I-S-E-S-T-L.org. And you can learn more about our organization there. We operate in St. Louis City, St. Louis County, Madison County, Illinois, and St. Clair County, Illinois. But we're also considering how do we broaden our perspective and broaden our footprint to help other communities, other neighborhoods outside of those particular places as well.
Excellent. Well, we'll put a link as well to Rise in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org, as well as a link to your new book, Family Feuds, Forgotten Bible Rivalries, and What the Church Can Relearn About Reconciliation. Terrell, it's always great to talk with you, and thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate this opportunity, and keep doing the work that you do, because it's just as important as well.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook, and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.